Okay, at long last, we're ready to treat the realistic case where the mean and the standard deviation are unknown and you have to take your estimates of those from the sample. So the good news is that we're now on realistic grounds. The bad news is that the calculation is more complicated than what we've been describing as we've been just going over terminology. But the good news about the bad news is that we can use the calculator to handle all the complications. So that in practice it's really not that complicated. Okay, so let's take an example. Suppose that the null hypothesis is that the average weight of NFL linebackers is 235 pounds, and the alternative hypothesis is that the average weight is greater. We take a sample of 16 linebackers and find that the average weight is 242 pounds with a sample standard deviation S of 14 pounds. The true standard deviation sigma is unknown, so here's how we conduct the test. We compute t equals, so we call this variable t, equal x bar minus mu over s over the square root of n. So this looks a lot like a z variable, except that we are using, instead of the unknown population standard deviation sigma, we're using the sample standard deviation s. And because we use the sample standard deviation, instead of calling it z, we call it t, because it turns out to have a t distribution. So in this case, we get a value of t of 2.0. Because the sample mean and the sample standard deviation are not strictly independent of one another, that is, both of them are computed using the same data, the same observations, the distribution of t is not exactly normal. So it's not, it doesn't exactly follow normal, which is why we can't use the z distribution. Although in large, really large samples we could, like hundreds of observations or more, then it becomes so close to normal, we might as well use a normal distribution. So it turns out that there are actually a family of t distributions that changes one for each level of the degrees of freedom. Whoa, degrees of freedom. There's a new term that I'm throwing in there. Where'd that come from? Well, for this type of t-test, the degrees of freedom is equal to the sample size minus 1, n minus 1. So in this case, we had a sample of 16, so the degrees of freedom is 15. If our sample had 23 observations, then the degrees of freedom would be 22. Now, why do we call it degrees of freedom? Because in a sense, we use by using the same observations twice, once to calculate the mean and once to calculate the standard deviation, we're in a sense using up a degree of freedom. I think that's about all I'll say about it conceptually about the term degrees of freedom. The important thing to remember right now is just it's equal to the sample size minus 1 for the type of test we're doing now. The table in the back of the book, on the back of the book there's a table that shows the t distribution. It's organized differently than the z table. It's almost an inside-out version of the z table. But the way it's organized is, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see df, stands for degrees of freedom, and there are different values down the left-hand side, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Across the top are possible p-values. Okay, so we can't see every possible p-value, but we can see a lot of important ones. We can see 0.25, 0.20. We can see the important one of 0.05 kind of in the middle there. So those are possible p-values. And then if we go into the middle of the table, what we're seeing are t-ratios. So again, it's sort of an inside-out version of the z-table. Okay, in our example, we have degrees of freedom is equal to 15. And t is equal to 2.0. So we look for that t in the middle of the table. First of all, we find the row where df equals 15. So where df equals 15, under 0.25, you would have 0.691, for example. Okay, but what we look inside is for the closest number to 2. So if we read across the row at df equals 15, what we find is a value of 1.753, and if we look up, that's in the same column headed by 0.05. And then we go over and we see a value of 2.131, and we look up and we see that's in the column headed by 0.025. So we can conclude from that that the p-value is somewhere between 0.025 and 0.05, and it's probably closer to 0.025. So if our significance level were 0.05, we would reject the null hypothesis and say that linebackers are heavier than 235 pounds. Okay, suppose we took a sample of 25 linebackers. The average weight turned out to be 238 pounds, and the sample standard deviation turned out to be 10 pounds. So now see if you can calculate t and find the approximate p-value. Well, for t, we take 238 minus 235, divide by the standard deviation divided by the square root of the sample size, and if you do all that, you get a value of 1.5. Then we look at the degrees of freedom, which will be 24, 25 minus 1. And in that row, we're looking for a t-value close to 1.5. Well, we find a value of 1.318 under the p-value of 0.10, and a value of 1.711 under the p-value of 0.05. So the p-value seems to be somewhere in between, in fact, almost halfway between those two values. So if we had a significance level of 0.05, we would, in this case, fail to reject the null hypothesis that the mean weight is 235 pounds. Okay, another thing we can do is calculate a confidence interval. If you look in this table in the back of the book, at the bottom, the confidence level is shown, and you can use that along with the degrees of freedom to read from the table a value of t star so that the margin of error can be calculated using t star times s over the square root of n. For example, suppose we wanted to take a 90% confidence interval for the sample mean in our sample of 25 observations with a mean of 238 and a standard deviation of 10. Okay, from the table, we look at the bottom for 90%. So we read across the bottom, we see 90%, and then we read up to the row with 24 degrees of freedom. And we see that inside the table, we get a The t value at that point is 1.711. That becomes our t star. We multiply that by 10 over the square root of 25, that is s over the square root of n. And when we do that, we get 3.422. So that's that converted our t star into natural units. So now we have the 90% confidence interval is 238 pounds, plus or minus 3.422 pounds. That's how you calculate a confidence interval using the table. However, chances are you will never use the table, either to calculate a hypothesis test or a confidence interval. You see, your calculator already knows how to calculate p-values exactly. You just go to stats, test, t-test. You enter the mu for the null hypothesis, the x bar, the s, in the n, and whether the alternative is greater than, a less than, or a two-sided alternative, and the calculator will give you give you the p-value. So that gives you the answer. Now, if you didn't have x bar and s, and all you had were the data, like let's say you had eight football players with weights like 251, 227, 239, 222, and so on. You had eight data points. You could enter those data points into a list and input the list into the t-test. So your calculator would do that also. Finally, you can use the calculator also to get a confidence interval. So instead of selecting a t-test, you select t-interval. So if we'd entered the so we select t-interval, and then we enter the x bar and the n, the sample size, and the s, the standard deviation. And then we also pick the confidence level we want to use, and the calculator will do the rest. Okay, the next topic is called matched pairs. Sometimes the data that you get come from a matched pairs study. Matched pairs uses, like, a typical example would be before and after. So let's say you wanted to look at the effect of a diet. You would weigh the subjects before they go on the diet, and then after they've been on the diet for, let's say, 4 months. And then you take for each subject in the study, you subtract the weight after the diet from the weight before the diet to give you how much weight each one lost. And so you would have a list of pounds lost by each subject. That's so you're what the way you're matching them is you're matching each person before and after, rather than just sort of lumping them all together before and lumping them all together afterward. Another example of matched pairs would be something called same store sales. If an analyst, a stock analyst, is trying to decide whether Hecht's sales this year are up significantly from last year, what they prefer to look at is rather than total sales at Hecht's this year versus total sales last year, they prefer to look at same store sales. So they want to look at the difference between the sales at a particular store this year minus last year. And you could do that for, let's say, 50 different Hecht stores. You could say, take the difference between the sales this year and last year. That's called same store sales. So that's another example of a matched pair design. Okay, so let's go back and look at how we do a matched pair calculation. As I said, in the example of a diet, you subtract the weight afterwards from the weight before for each subject. So if Alex lost 4 pounds, then you would say that the value is 4. If Frank gained 2 pounds, the value would be -2. That is, if Frank was 135 before and 137 pounds afterward, we subtract 137 from 135 and we get -2. That is, so his weight loss was -2. Okay, so we take the average value of all the weight loss in this sample. And suppose that we had a sample size of 9 men. The average weight loss was 3.5 pounds, and the standard deviation was 3 pounds. Okay, we can enter all this data into the t-test. The null hypothesis in a matched pair test is almost always that mu equals zero. That is, you assume that there is no difference before and after, or there's no change in same store sales or whatever. So we assume that the null hypothesis is that there's no weight loss, and so what we're testing is was there a significant amount of weight loss? So we enter the data in the t-test. Just as we did before, except for the null hypothesis, we put mu equals zero. The alternative in this case would be mu greater than zero. That is, we actually do lose weight. There's a positive weight loss in the sample, and then we enter it into the t-test and calculate a p-value and go on from there. The next topic is two samples. Now, a two sample t-test is actually a completely different test than a one-sample t-test. How could that arise? Suppose we gave the diet to a set of women and to a set of men, and we want to see if the average weight loss is the same for men and for women. That is an example of a two-sample test. So suppose that 16 women tried the diet, and the average weight loss for them was 2 pounds, and the standard deviation was 4 pounds, whereas before we said 9 men took the diet with an average weight loss of 3.5 pounds and standard deviation of 3 pounds. Okay, so to see whether the difference between the men and women is significant, so the null hypothesis is that they're the same, you select two sample t-tests from the calculator. So we do not select pooled. By the way, when we do the two test, when you select the two sample t-test, it asks you to input an X1, an N1, and an S1. We could use that all those values from the men. X1 would be 3.5, N1 would be 9, S1 would be 3. It also asks for an X2, an N2, and an S2. We could take that from the women. The X2, I guess, was 2 pounds. The S2 was 4, and the N2 was 16. That was the sample size. So you enter that, and then at one point it asks you is it pooled or not? And almost always you select that it's not pooled, or pooled equals no. I'll explain that one in a minute. All right, so you calculate the p-value, and I think in this example you probably should fail to reject the null hypothesis that the weight loss is identical. I'm not exactly sure, but my guess is that will happen at a 5% significance level. You will not, the p-value will not be below 0.05. Now, I'll explain some of the stuff with pools and everything. The degrees of formula in a two-sample test is not an integer, which is sort of weird. What it is a weighted average of the degrees of freedom in the separate samples. So it's going to be, it's not exactly 9, it's not exactly 16, it's sort of in between, it's kind of a weighted average. So I guess the degrees of freedom in the single samples would be 8 and 15 because it's n minus 1. But the degrees of freedom in the combined sample or the two samples is neither one. Okay, so that the anyway, the formula is kind of a mess. I've never seen an instance where somebody really had to know the formula on the AP, but they give it to you so you and you should just be able to recognize it. But I don't think it's a big deal to know the formula for calculating that weird weighted average. Anyway, it's a good idea. This is what makes the calculator great. The calculator does everything in the background, so you don't have to know it. Okay, and that this is where the term pooled means. If for some reason you believe that the standard deviation is identical between the two populations, that is, you don't know what the standard deviation is, but whatever it is, you're convinced that it's identical between the two populations, then you would say it's pooled. Anyway, that's an aside. Again, that issue I don't think is really critical. The main point is the degrees of freedom is a complicated calculation. It doesn't typically come out to be an integer, and it's nice to have a calculator to produce it, that it'll be part of the output from the calculator. Okay, so let's do an example. Suppose we want to test to see whether linebackers weigh the same today as 20 years ago, and now instead of being given what they weighed 20 years ago, we're going to have a sample of what they weighed 20 years ago. So we take a sample from 20 years ago and a sample today. Today's sample, let's say we have 25 linebackers, average weight 238 pounds, standard deviation of 10. And a sample from 20 years ago, let's say we had 18 linebackers, average weight 234 pounds, standard deviation of 8 pounds. You enter that all into the calculator, and I'm pretty sure you would reject the null hypothesis that they have the same weight. Another thing you could do with that data is calculate a two-sample t-interval. That's a separate thing under stats test, two-sample t-interval. And you enter all the data, and you pick a confidence interval, let's say 90% confidence interval, and the calculator will give you the confidence interval. In this case, it would be for a confidence interval for the difference between the two means. It would be a confidence interval for the difference between the two means, not a confidence interval for either one of the means separately. Okay, so that's all the calculations involving t-tests. I've kind of breezed through that. We're going to do many, many examples in homework. And let me list some good habits to get into, especially for doing work on the AP. Okay, first, when you get a problem, determine what type of test it is. Is it a regular old one-sample t-test? Is it matched pairs? Or is it a two-sample test? Remember that a one-sample test and a matched pairs test are both calculated in the calculator just using a regular t-test. The difference is the matched pairs, you know that the null hypothesis is going to be zero for zero change, zero difference between the matched pairs. Okay, so determine what type of test, that's step one. Step two is check that assumptions are reasonable. It's important on the AP, they really care that you aren't just blindly conducting a test, but you're checking to see that the data are not wildly inconsistent with the assumptions you need for the test. In particular, the assumption that you need for a t-test is that either the sample has to be large or the data have to be close to normal. So for really small samples, or 15, let's say 15 or less, the boundary isn't super precise. I mean, it's not like a sample size of 16, all of a sudden everything's fine. But for really small samples, the data have to be close to normal. If they're particularly skewed in a small sample, a t-test really is not appropriate. You really don't have any kind of appropriate test if you have a small sample with highly skewed data. For as the sample size gets larger, skewness in the data is not so bad. The data can be pretty far from normal if you have a sample of 100. You don't have to worry about the data being normal when you have a large enough sample size. Okay, so that's step two. Step three, state the null and alternative hypotheses in words. Also note whether the alternative is one-sided or two-sided. Okay, step four, state the null and alternative hypotheses in symbols. That is, define mu, say let mu equal, and then give some words, and then you write down H naught, mu equals blah blah blah, HA, mu greater than, or whatever the alternative hypothesis would be. Step five, show the data that you're entering into your calculator. See, I'm going to assume that you're going to just at this point enter data into your calculator to compute everything. And so the only way that someone who's grading your work can audit what you did is if you explain exactly what you entered in the calculator. And that way, first of all, we know that you got the result yourself as opposed to just copying everything from somebody. And secondly, if you entered something wrong, we can understand why you got an answer that is different from the correct one. So you show the data that you're about to enter into your calculator. You write down what the sample size n equals, what x bar equals, what s equals. If it's two sample, you would put what n1, x1, and s1 are, what n2, x2, and s2 are. Finally, you report the results. So remember to include the degrees of freedom so that people remember that you understand that there are degrees of freedom involved in a t-test, and report the p-value because that's really the most important thing. Finally, state the conclusion in words. So you say, for example, at a 5% level of significance, we fail to reject the null hypothesis that today's linebackers on average weigh 235 pounds. That would be a way of stating the conclusion in words. Okay, that's it.